The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Smith, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Louise Dovray Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Wednesday, April 10th. We have three matters on the calendar for oral argument this morning. The first is 2700 Appellant or Hennepin LLC versus BPC Minneapolis Uptown Pizza et al. Counsel, I'll just remind you, we each have 15 minutes to make your argument, and counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. The podium can be raised and lowered to your comfort. There's a button sort of underneath the middle. So please, and with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Your Honors, I'm Rob Shanis. With me is my colleague, Monica Davies. We represent guarantor VPC Pizza Operating Corporation, the appellant. May it please the court, guarantor brings this appeal because the district court was inconsistent. It correctly granted summary judgment, ruling that guarantor's liability was limited to 1 year of rent, but incorrectly applied that same decision to attorney's fees. On the other hand, Your Honors, landlord seeks reversal of summary judgment not by renewing the arguments that it made below, but by introducing new evidence and making new arguments for the first time before this court. Even landlords' new arguments fail as a matter of law. We ask this court to uphold.
What's the new arguments, just so I'm clear about that?
Sure, Your Honor. There are two new arguments raised. The first one, and what I'll do, Your Honor, is I'll recite the two arguments, then I'll go into each of them. The first one is that appellant failed to provide specific evidence of property insurance and that somehow defeats the summary judgment motion. The second one is that the landlord claims now on appeal for the first time that it actually did give notice of a breach. Okay. As for the property insurance argument, Your Honor, we've briefed this repeatedly throughout the briefing. Landlord has said that the issue was a failure to name them as an additional insured under commercial liability policy. On appeal, landlord says, no, you failed to generate evidence of naming them on a property insurance policy. The best analogy I can give to this, Your Honors, is that there's a contract where I'm obligated to buy you a car with a V6 engine. You then say repeatedly in your briefing, you failed to buy us a Honda Pilot, you failed to buy us a Honda Pilot, you failed to buy us a Honda Pilot. We respond by proving that we did in fact buy you a Honda Pilot. On appeal, you then argue, you didn't buy me a vehicle with a V6 engine. Your Honors, I did not look under the hood of the car because you said to buy a Honda Pilot. Here, repeatedly, they said, buy a commercial liability policy. You didn't name us on a commercial liability policy. We responded by establishing that we did. Of course, Your Honor, that issue has always been a red herring because even if there was a breach of contract, there's no default because there was no notice and opportunity to cure, which brings us to the next changed argument.
That's what I was going to ask you. There seemed to be a lot of time on what was provided, what wasn't provided. Isn't the key issue what you just said, whether there's been a notice of default and opportunity to cure?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's true because there are essentially three elements that need to be established for a default. There needs to be a breach, a notice of an opportunity to cure, and a failure to cure. And as the movement below, we focused on this idea that there was no notice and opportunity to cure. We met our burden by presenting evidence in the form of testimony that the guarantor had never received any notice of a breach during the first 36 months of the lease term. As Your Honors know, lack of proof on one element, for instance, a breach of contract, I don't have to come in and prove that there was or wasn't a breach if I can show that there was or wasn't causation or wasn't damages. Then the burden shifts to the other side. Under the decision of Minnesota Supreme Court in Thiel v. Stitch, it clearly says the burden shifts at that point and that we have no duty to anticipate every argument that they might make.
But it's true here that the respondent on the cross motions for partial summary judgment raised the issue of default by virtue of not identifying landlord as an additional insured. I mean, that issue was presented on the cross motions for summary judgment, was it not?
Right. Their argument has consistently been that there was a default because there was a breach of contract.
Right.
But a default...
And one of which, I mean, one of which was failure to pay rent, but, I mean, the primary one, right? But the other one that was alleged on cross motions was, hey, you didn't name us as an additional insured. And certainly that they provided evidence that that was true at the time in 2020. But I understand your argument being that that isn't proof that they hadn't done so back in 2015, 2017,
sure.
Correct?
And that's one of the arguments, and that's the argument that the district court ruled based on, that there was no evidence of a breach in 2017.
But I want to get back to the point about what kind of insurance, because I agree with you, you know, in looking back at the summary judgment motions, I mean, most of the references were to CGL, liability insurance. And I, from the record, it appears that, in fact, your client did produce evidence that, in fact, the landlord was an additional insured for purposes of CGL coverage during this relevant three-year period, the first 3 years of the lease term. But, I mean, always, this has been about property damage, right? I mean, that was the whole impetus for the claim to Liberty Mutual was for a property damage claim. So how does the provision of the CGL certificates defeat a fact question as to whether, in fact, your client was in default for failing to name landlord as an additional insured with respect to property coverage?
Well, the property damage that would be covered under the lease is called landlord's plate glass. That's the only part of the property at all that would be landlord's. I don't know what kind of policy covers landlord plate glass. So when they argue that there's CGL coverage is what's missing, I operate on the assumption that they know that it would have been covered by CGL coverage, and I present a response saying here's the CGL coverage. I do want to emphasize that it really doesn't matter for two reasons. One is there's no admissible evidence of a breach when all they present is a hearsay letter from an insurer dealing with 2020 insurance coverage. Second, there's no evidence in the record of a notice of default, and this is where the argument shifts on their part. They very clearly say below that the reason they couldn't give notice is they didn't know until 2020. Okay? Now they say something different. Now they say that there's these emails in the record that show that they knew and gave notice. And I want to be very careful here because their briefing is deceiving. They point to the first email where the landlord says, you need to give us a different certificate of insurance. The one you gave us isn't good enough. What they don't tell you, Your Honors, is that Exhibit 4 of that same declaration, this is at Index 48, the declaration of Brent Johnson, is their response when they received the new certificate. Thanks, Chris. Everything looks good. Okay? Approving of the certificate. Now they want to turn around and say, having approved of the certificate, that that was a breach. If at all, if anything, they told us that we cured. Now, years later, they want to say that that's a breach. The district court addressed an almost identical issue with respect to the issue not being appealed, with respect to the construction agreement. In that instance, the same thing virtually happened. The landlord signed an amendment to the lease saying, okay, you did this thing that was a breach, we accept it, and then later turned around and tried to argue that, in fact, it was a breach. The very thing that we approved of subsequently was a breach. In that context, the district court did address the requirements for notice and specifically said you need to adhere to the notice requirements in the lease, that you've given no notice. And look here, we have examples of what a notice looks like according to the landlord. We have examples of a notice to cure the rent default in which you plainly say you have breached the lease. It will be a default if you don't cure by X date. Very clear language. Here now, for the first time on appeal, they argue that this email constituted somehow a notice. These arguments that weren't raised below go hand in hand with the recitation of the record, which is almost entirely citations to the trial court record, to the trial record. The law's very clear that when you're appealing a motion for summary judgment, this court is limited to reviewing the record established on summary judgment. Now, one of the arguments that is made in the reply brief, and most of these arguments that I'm addressing were made for the first time in their reply brief, which is why I'm emphasizing them today. One of the arguments is that we couldn't have known about this default because guarantor or tenant was holding all the cards, had all the insurance policies. Now, that's not true for two reasons. One is that the lease plainly entitles landlord to ask for anything it wants concerning insurance during the lease term. And in this case, really what we've gotten is an ostrich with its head in the sand issue. You're given the certificates of insurance. You could ask for whatever you want. You can ask for entire policies. We're led to believe that we fully complied because you send an email saying that we have. And then you lie in wait until many years later and claim that you just learned about this. Two is that this was a cross motion for summary judgment where both parties agreed that there was no issues of disputed fact.
And nobody asked under 5604 to hold the, to delay ruling on summary judgment so that additional discovery could be conducted.
That's exactly right. And that's exactly what one would have done if that were the case. The other thing I'll emphasize is having presented the certificates of liability insurance below, at no point then did the landlord respond in the summary judgment briefing by saying, wait a minute, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about property insurance. That issue was not raised by landlord until 3 weeks before trial when it asked the court for permission to bring a motion for reconsideration. That's the first time where anyone ever said property insurance. In fact, if you run a search of the briefs below, the words property insurance don't appear in any of the briefing from landlord, and they don't appear in the record of the summary judgment hearing either. The words property insurance are absent from all of that. And yet, they would lead this court to believe that a major error was a failure to address property insurance. And my emphasis, Your Honors, we do not have to address whether there was a breach, although the district court was plainly correct in ruling that there was no evidence of breach under the hearsay rule, but also the relevance, which is the basis the district court did rule. The district court went on to say, I don't have to reach that issue, but it's not correct what landlord now argues, that you should reverse for further consideration because the issue wasn't considered. The issue of notice was plainly considered and extensively addressed by the district court with respect to the other issue, but the fact that a district court says, I don't need to decide that question because the prior issue of relevance is dispositive doesn't mean the issue wasn't considered. It clearly was considered, and there's no basis to remand to district court because nobody believes there's any other facts. All the facts are before you. The legal conclusions.
But we'd be making a legal finding of fact, or finding a fact as an appellate court, wouldn't we?
No, you wouldn't, but you would draw the legal conclusions on a de novo basis, which is the standard of review. And nobody is saying, well, we wanted the opportunity to discover more facts because, as Your Honor pointed out, there was no request to conduct further discovery. So the facts are what the record is on summary judgment. And there's nothing whatsoever in the facts allowing the landlord to establish any of the elements of a default. Now, turning to the attorney fee issue, the district court got it right on summary judgment, and there's no reason to think that there's any distinction between Section 1 and Section 2 of the guarantee. Section 1 addresses rent, Your Honor.
Well, Section 1, as I read it, says the guarantor is guaranteeing tenants' complete performance of all of tenants' covenants and obligations under the lease. That, to me, would include rent and include buying insurance and include all the other parts of the lease agreement, right?
Yes.
And then the second provision of the agreement is the guarantor of payment of costs incurred in enforcing the obligations. Those do seem like two different things to me.
Yes, and maybe I misspoke, Your Honor. They are certainly different, but the notwithstanding clause deals with them both. When you say notwithstanding the foregoing, right, you're saying notwithstanding anything that came before this paragraph in terms of liabilities. When you use the word notwithstanding the foregoing, the liabilities of guarantors shall be limited to, you're referring to all liabilities.
Counsel, in Section 2, though, how do you answer that with regard to the phrase without limitation, including without limitation reasonable fees, that almost seems at a minimum equal to, if not trumping, the notwithstanding, because it's already said there'll be no limitation.
Well, let's substitute the word not without limitation for all, because that's what it means. All attorney's fees, all costs without limitation. In other words, all the liabilities with respect to cost and attorney's fees are covered by Section 2. Let's assume that that's what it means. That's the broadest possible interpretation. Then down at the bottom, you have a provision that says notwithstanding the foregoing. Notwithstanding the foregoing means what it says. It means notwithstanding anything in terms of liability that we've said anywhere in this document up to this point, this is the limitation.
But if you read the rest of paragraph 15, though, I mean, the limitation has to do with the liabilities, meaning the obligations and covenants. I mean, why wouldn't we read 15 in its entirety to say we're talking about the underlying obligations of the tenant here?
Well, I think what it says is notwithstanding all liabilities, and it's not limited to any specific liability. What it doesn't say, Your Honor, is notwithstanding the foregoing, all liabilities are limited with the exception of attorney's fees. It doesn't have that. I see my time is up, Your Honor. If you have any further questions, I'm happy to answer them.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank
you,
counsel. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Judge Bjorkman, and may it please the court. My name is Mark Bradford. I represent the respondent, 2700 Hennepin LLC. I'm going to pick up where Mr. Shanis left off, which is on the issue of attorney's fees, and then I'll transition back to the summary judgment piece, which occupied most of the argument this morning. Just real quickly on the attorney's fees piece, there are, I think, six textual clues in the guarantee that paragraph 15 does not address the same subject matter as paragraph 2. And really, that's the test under the business bank case that my friend cites, which is the notwithstanding clause really serves to preempt another clause in the contract that deals with the same subject matter. So the question is, do those two clauses deal with the same subject matter? Paragraph 15 deals with limiting guarantor's liability for tenant's lease obligation. Judge Bjorkman, as you inquired about the traditional incidence of the leasehold interest, the payment of rent, et cetera. It's clearly geared toward rent obligations, not attorney's fees. Paragraph 2 includes a specific fee-shifting provision for fees associated with establishing the guarantor's own breach of the contract. That independent clause has nothing to do with the tenant. You'll see in paragraph 15 that clause references the tenant at least four times. Paragraph 15 does not refer to fees anywhere. And it's
sorry, Mr. Bradford, could you go back to what paragraph 2 is missing that you're saying? I'm
so paragraph
just a little fast.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Paragraph 2 specifically refers to liability for attorney's fees. Mm-hmm. Paragraph 15 says nothing about attorney's fees, right? So that's one clue as to whether they deal with the same subject matter. Whereas if you compare that to paragraph 1, Your Honor, which does mention rent, paragraph 15 measures the guarantor's liability by using rent. It would be rather anomalous, too, I think, as Judge Sleater pointed out, and somewhat superfluous, for a guarantee to state that it extends to all of landlord's expenses, including, quote unquote, without limitation, reasonable attorney's fees, if attorney's fees are then limited by paragraph 15. And of course, there's easy ways to contract around this. Paragraph 2 could simply say, subject to the limitation in paragraph 15, and then go on. And then lastly, paragraph 15 has a sort of a temporal character to it. It says beginning on the 37th month of the lease, this is what our obligations are going to be. That seems to be incompatible with it applying to attorney's fees because, of course, you're looking at beginning on the 37th month, what are the lessor's obligations under the lease? Rent, payment of additional rent expenses. Again, this gets back to what 15 was intended to cover. So in our view, the district court is squarely on good ground in holding that paragraph 15 does not apply to attorney's fees or limit attorney's fees.
And in your argument, are you primarily relying on the language of the guarantee itself?
Yes.
I know there's references by both parties to case law that seems not exactly on point.
I agree with that, Your Honor. Right. I think the plain language rule is the best guide here, and the plain language of the contract suggests that paragraph 15 does not apply to attorney's fees. Ultimately, our view is you don't even have to reach that issue, because the more efficient route and the more direct route here is a reversal on the issue that we raise in our cross appeal. If you agree with us on that, you really don't even have to address the limitation on paragraph 15. I just want to be very clear with the court on one significant point. When we are asking for reversal of the summary judgment order, we are not asking this court to analyze, consider any evidence that was not presented as part of the summary judgment record. Clearly, we provided some background in our brief about what happened after the summary judgment order was entered into to explain why the issue we're appealing is significant. But I am not standing here, and I will not ask you to consider anything outside of the summary judgment record. Our point is simply this. Based on what was presented in the summary judgment record, an inference can be made that the landlord or tenant did not comply with the obligation in paragraph 23.02 to buy property insurance and name landlord as an additional insured within the first 3 years of the lease.
And what do you point to as the primary evidence of record that the district court should have drawn that inference?
Sure. So there's three pieces, Your Honor. Number one, we know that in 2021, we received, after making a property damage claim to Liberty Mutual, we received a letter from the insurer saying, you cannot assert a property damage claim because you are not a named insured, and the named insured did not ask that you be added as an additional insured. I will spot them that doesn't in and of itself establish that we were never an additional insured. Let's spot them that. The second,
right, the critical point is the first 36 months.
Right, and so the second piece I would point to is the email, which is index number 48, exhibit 2, which was back in 2015 when we were provided a certificate of liability insurance and we said, hey, this doesn't address property insurance. So there was at least some indication that we were not named as an additional insured at the inception or in 2020. The third piece I would refer to is the insurance certificates that they actually produced, which were all liability certificates, none of which were property certificates.
And so, you agree that the 2015, there was an actual exchange of emails, right?
Yes.
And that culminated, I think, as your colleague indicated in his argument in chief, with the okay looks good to us.
Yeah, and pardon me, Your Honor, I didn't mean to interrupt you. And the liability certificate did look good. There is not testimony from either the sender or the recipient of that email with respect to exactly what it was they meant by looks good, whether they're referring to the fact that the liability certificate looked good or we're excusing you from producing evidence of a property insurance breach. Irrespective of that, Judge, when you look at the evidence that was presented, there, in my view, there are two inferences that can be drawn. Either they never named us as an additional insured, because we know at least we weren't in 2020, or they did name us as an additional insured, and then for some unexplained reason, took us off of the policy after the first 3 years. When you have competing inferences to be drawn from the evidence, we're entitled as the non-moving party to the benefit of the inference. That's what this case is all about. It's a basic application of the summary judgment standard. Yes, Judge
Sears. I asked the counsel for appellant the same question. Isn't the real issue, though, ideally, of course, you'd have perhaps attached to a notice of default and the policy that is missing naming your client as a additional insured, but isn't the real issue the notice of default and opportunity to cure? Because we're looking back in time now to the key 36 months. And so if that's absent, then isn't all this talk about whether we can make inferences kind of down the road? That's
Right.
The
so
key,
let me answer it in two ways, Judge Sleater. First, we're playing the cards we've been dealt from the district court. The district court made its decision based exclusively on whether there was evidence of a breach, and it expressly said, therefore, I am not going to decide at this point the party's arguments regarding notice. Okay. So the district court, for lack of a better term, punted on that issue. Our view, Your Honor, is if we're right that there is evidence from which a jury could conclude that there was a breach, the case should be remanded to the district court to make that notice call in the first place. So we're not, and I want to address the argument that you know, we're making a new argument on appeal regarding notice. I don't want the court to decide notice at all. I'm simply pointing out when the case is remanded, there are good arguments with respect to the notice provision. I'm not asking you to decide those. And let me say one other thing. I do believe there's evidence of notice, but assuming that there's not, Judge Sleater, we made an argument below that really applying the notice provision in this particular context would work a disservice to the parties, because insurance is not like non-payment of rent, where you can simply go out and cure the breach by paying what's owed. Once you fail to name somebody as an additional insured for a policy period, you can't go back and retroactively add them. So there really is no opportunity to cure that breach. So we raised, I think, some good arguments below as to whether it would be fair to even apply that provision to this particular breach. But setting that aside, these are questions for the district court to answer on remand. Our position is simply, let's look at what's in the record, and is there evidence from which a jury could conclude there was a breach? We think there is, because on the summary judgment standard, we're entitled to a reasonable inference. I don't think it's a reasonable inference to say we may have been added and then removed. Nobody has ever explained why in the world that would happen. The only reasonable inference to be drawn from this evidence is that we were never added. And let me just address
how is that reasonable when we have not one but two affidavits from the CFO of guarantor saying, you know what, we were not in default. Tenant was not in default the first 36 months of this. I mean, isn't that competent evidence that can support summary judgment, correct?
Well, right. So, but follow the sequence, Judge Bjorkman. So they move for summary judgment. They have an affidavit from the tenant saying, we believe we fully complied within the first 36 months. We respond and we say, we don't think you did because we weren't added as an additional insured.
And there were other arguments. And, that was
right.
Not the only
and then,
issue.
And then that same gentleman's response is to put in the certificates of liability insurance.
Right, to which your client did not object and say, hey, that's not property insurance. That's not the right insurance.
Well, I think an oral argument, Your Honor, there was some discussion about that. And I think I can point you, if I remember correctly, it's around page 20 or 21 that there was some discussion about that. The first mention of liability insurance at oral argument actually came from appellant's counsel, and it's on page 25.
Summary judgment briefing is all about CGL, right?
Well, so, Your Honor, I thought we tried to address that in our brief, and I regret that my client's former lawyer called the property damage provision CGL. He quoted the right provision and then called it CGL. Mr. Shanis referenced an analogy. To me, that's like saying this case is all about the First Amendment. We're going to quote the First Amendment, but because the lawyer screwed up and called it the Second Amendment, all of a sudden my arguments don't apply. Everyone knew that this was about property insurance.
But referring to CGL, then in response, the appellant providing certificates of the CGL coverage, naming your client as an additional insured, and then no further reference to that being inadequate or... You know, you talked about the district, you know, we're dealing with the cards the district court dealt us. Well, the district court was dealing with the cards dealt to it.
If you look at the district court's own order, Judge Bjorkman, I believe it's on page 8, I may be mistaken, but the court even references the obligation to procure property insurance. And the court doesn't rely on any of the certificates of insurance that were provided on the liability side. The court simply said, you, 2700, have the affirmative obligation to come forward with evidence of a breach. And our position is, well, we're the party responding to summary judgment, number one. Number two, they're the party seeking to invoke paragraph 15, which is an exception, right, to paragraph one of the guarantee, which is a full guarantee. They're saying we're entitled to this limitation, which requires us to show that the tenant was in full compliance with the lease. Our position is they were the party that had to come forward with competent evidence to show the tenant fully complied once we notified them of this issue. I regret that there was a misnomer of the clause that we were relying on, but there was no confusion about what clause we were actually relying on because it's quoted in the brief. This issue came up as a property damage issue. We made a property damage claim, and the claim was denied. This was always about property damage coverage. So, again, we think this is a basic application of the summary judgment principle. All these arguments about notice, which Judge Sleeter, I will acknowledge, are important, can be resolved on remand because the district court punted on them in the first instance. So we're asking the court to reverse the grant of summary judgment, not reach the issue of the extent of paragraph 15, but if you do reach paragraph 15, we'd ask you to affirm on the grounds I've articulated. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Shanus, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Your Honors, I want to address one item raised by my colleague, Mr. Bradford, concerning summary judgment, and then head right to some of the issues Judge Sleeter raised in my initial argument. So concerning summary judgment, you do not get a favorable inference from inadmissible evidence. So when Mr. Bradford says a reasonable jury could conclude X, Y, and Z, that letter is hearsay. It never makes it in front of a jury. You don't get an inference based on inadmissible evidence. As for the attorney's fee issue, Judge Sleeter, you asked about this including without limitation provision. And Section 2 deals with landlord's expenses, and then including without limitation goes on to list examples of expenses the landlord had. Those expenses include enforcing the obligations of tenant and incurred enforcement guarantee. So two things there. One is its expenses, and two is it does include tenant's expenses. If your honors agree that expenses are a form of liability, then the notwithstanding clause applies to Section 2 because it applies to all liabilities, not just liabilities concerning rent. Rent is the remedy that's still available when the notwithstanding clause applies. It is not at all uncommon, particularly in restaurant leases, to have a temporally limited guarantee. A restaurant is likely to fail, if at all, during the first 3 years of the lease. And so it's not at all uncommon for a landlord to insist on a guarantee. On the other hand, the guarantor is in no way going to continue to be liable for the duration of the lease. At a certain point after of time, the landlord is in partnership with the tenant and can no longer look to the guarantor to support the lease. And that is what the parties negotiated here. And it is contrary to what they negotiated to suggest that the guarantor is not liable for some liabilities, but somehow continues to be liable for others, particularly given the fact that it's quite plausible that the landlord will sue the tenant at some point for unpaid rent, given the duration of the lease term. The suggestion that the guarantor would be liable for all those fees, even though it's not a party to that proceeding, and even if it satisfies its obligation to pay 12 months of rent, presents an absurdity that defeats the purpose of Section 15. We did cite case law, and I agree, Judge Bjorkman, that they're not entirely on point, but they are at least illustrative. The issue in United Prairie Bank and Podvin v. Jamar address whether the district court was right that somehow attorney's fees are different. They're just categorically different. The case law is clear that attorney's fees are not. Contractual liability that includes attorney's fees is contractual liability. The notwithstanding—
For purposes of a jury, getting an entitlement to a jury trial. I mean, that's what United Prairie Bank
absolutely.
Is about.
Absolutely. For purposes of a jury trial, but for any purposes, really. I mean, if you have contractual liability, it's different than statutory contractual fees. It's different than statutory fees, which vest that as something different. It's not somehow an equitable remedy. it's among the list of things that you sue for breach of contract, and that's what happened here, and it would have gone to a jury but for the party's stipulation to simplify the case and present it on paper. And had it gone to a jury, it would have been decided on a jury verdict form like any other liability. I guess my point is, it's a liability. The word liability in a notwithstanding clause, it doesn't mean anything special. It means all liabilities. And it is contradictory to say, on the one hand, your liability is limited to 12 months rent, but you're also still liable for Section 2 attorney's fees, but not for Section 1 rent. In other words, the agreement the parties reached, and consistent with the case law of what notwithstanding anything to the contrary and the word liability means, is that Section 15 must apply to anything foregoing that is a liability. Your honors would have to decide that somehow attorney's fees are not a liability within the definition of the law to reach a conclusion that guarantor is responsible for attorney's fees. And there is no case law cited by the landlord that could lead you to that conclusion. However, we have cited case law, full paragraphs of it, explaining that liability is construed in the broadest possible sense to include all monetary liability, all monetary penalties of any kind. There's nothing in the case law that anyone could point to somehow distinguish attorney's fees as special. And that's where the district court got it wrong. The guarantor has paid its 12 months of rent. And so we ask your honors to reverse the decision on attorney's fees. Unless your honors have any further questions, I see my time is up.
I see none. Thank you. Thank you both for your helpful arguments and briefing. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.